Thanks for listening to High Education. I'm Amelia Day, lifetime educator and social justice activist, recording from my studio apartment. Today I'm joined by Jill, a school counselor serving students in kindergarten through 8th grade in her Californian school district. We will be discussing the impact a counselor has on their school community, how resources have influenced the effectiveness of counselors' efforts, and best practices for helping our at-risk populations find success in school and life. I want to express my gratitude for Jill taking the time during these difficult and busy times to speak with me today. Her name has been changed to protect her privacy. I hope to continue having guest speakers on to give their perspectives on their favorite educational topics. If you are a teacher, administrator, paraprofessional, speech pathologist, or otherwise engaged in the education of our youth, visit highedpod.com to contact me to let me know you're interested. All right, guys, I'm so excited to introduce Jill to you. She is a friend of mine who is also a school counselor. So Jill, if you could tell us a bit about yourself, specifically your professional background, but a bit about you personally as well.
Yeah, hi, thank you so much for having me. So I am a school counselor at in a district in California. And this is my second year as a full-time counselor. I absolutely love it, but it was quite a journey to get here. So a little bit about me, although I love school now, and that's why I'm a counselor, I wasn't always too good at school. When I was in elementary, I always felt really lost, like I wasn't really able to retain information, and I just knew I was lower academically than all of my peers. And that continued into middle school. I was put into remedial math classes and I got low grades, but no one ever really asked me, what's going on? What do you need? And how can I help you? And that kind of continued throughout middle school and throughout high school. I kept getting low grades and putting in remedial classes, and it seemed like because I didn't have behaviors or I wasn't a distraction to classes, that I kind of wasn't really noticed by any teachers or any administrators. It was kind of just like I was low academically, but because I didn't cause any problems, I think maybe no one thought to really intervene. And it got to the point where I almost didn't graduate from high school because I was so low academically and I had really low grades and I didn't have enough units to graduate. So I had to go to a continuation school in my district, which was really hard for me to leave all my friends and go to a school where I didn't know anyone. And I think I was there, I wasn't there a full year. I was there for about a semester, so like 5 or 6 months, and I got my units and I went back to my high school and I graduated. But it was very difficult for me. No one ever really talked to me about college, about applying for college. And I guess people thought it wasn't something I was interested in because I wasn't really good at school. So I just kind of on my own applied for a community college. I started taking classes that I really enjoyed, and I kind of learned how to be good at school and how to be a good student. And I graduated from Cal State East Bay with my bachelor's degree in human development with a specialization in childhood development. And after graduating, I didn't really have a path. I didn't really know what my career was going to be or what I wanted to do with my life. So I started working at a school for students with special needs, which was a really special point in my life because I got to be surrounded by these students who were absolutely amazing and taught me so much. And I had a few different roles there. I worked in the classroom as an aide. I worked as a sub and went around to different classrooms. And I also was an IEP coordinator. And during my time there, I just realized this is amazing, but I want to do more and I want to help more students than I am now. So I applied for a few different graduate programs for a master's degree in counseling. I applied for one school twice and got rejected 2 years in a row, which was really heartbreaking. I felt really defeated, especially since because I felt my whole life I did I wasn't good with academics, so getting rejected twice was very, very hard for me. And I made one last attempt. I applied for a different school and I got in. And when I found out I got in, I just started crying and I was so happy and I couldn't believe it. And I was so excited, but I knew this is probably going to be the hardest thing I'm ever going to do. And it was the hardest thing I've ever done. I did the program for 2 years full time. I wrote my master's thesis on using cognitive behavioral therapy in school-based groups for children who have witnessed domestic violence. And writing that like 70-page paper was very, very difficult, but I did it and I graduated. And now I've been a counselor for 2 years. And I still, some days, I can't believe I am where I am.
Wow, Jill, so that's a really amazing story. I'm so glad that you shared your background as a student from your young age, because I think that a lot of times those who feel pulled to work with students who are struggling are often the ones who overcame the struggles themselves. Speaking personally, I was diagnosed with dyslexia in second grade, and I'm so thankful that I was noticed and that I had great instructors who were able to catch me and who were able to give me the interventions that I needed, because I could have very easily have fallen through the cracks just like you. And you make an excellent point that it's often the students who are so quiet and don't cause behavior issues, those are the ones who are not getting the services that they need, because a lot of times we're so overwhelmed by the ones whose behaviors are displaying a need for interventions. So I'm very encouraged by your story, and I feel like with your background, you are more likely to be able to connect with the kids you're working with on a deeper level. I'm really excited to get to talk with you today. My next question is, can you describe what a school counselor does in a public school?
Yes, so a school counselor is a person who is there to provide support to mostly to the students, but also parents and teachers. So for supporting students, I do a lot of counseling groups. So for instance, for kindergarten, I have an art therapy group. For like grades 2 through 5, I have a mindfulness group, a grief group, an emotional regulation group, a friendship group, and then for middle school groups such as like Zen Zone, other mindfulness, friendships, as well as groups, I do a lot of one-on-one counseling, which I think is my favorite because I really like that one-on-one connection with students. When you are with a student 30 minutes for 6 to 8 weeks, it's kind of amazing the kind of bond and relationship that you create with them. And I feel like it's definitely a lot easier for me personally to support students in a one-on-one setting, whereas groups is a little bit more difficult, but they also get that social interaction, which I think is really beneficial. So supporting students as well as groups and one-on-one counseling, I go into classrooms and do presentations. Our district focuses a lot on integrity and action traits, is what we call them. So each month, all the schools in our district focus on a single trait. So this month is responsibility, maybe next month is empathy, and after that is kindness and perseverance. So each month I create lessons designed one for kindergarten through second grade, and then a different lesson for third through fifth grade, just because they're at different learning levels and the ability to understand something like empathy is going to be a lot different for a first grader than it will be for a fifth grader. So I do a lot of those lessons. I also go in and I teach about mindfulness, stress reduction. And also, teachers can always come to me and say, like, I have a few kids who are having problems with this, or my whole class is struggling with mindfulness. Can you come in for a few weeks and teach? So I really like that part of my job where I get to go into classrooms and I get to be the teacher for maybe 20 or 30 minutes. I also support teachers by doing consultation. So teachers will come to me if they have a student in their class who is really struggling academically, then I support the teacher with that. I also support them with social and emotional learning and support for students. So it's different now that we're doing online learning. But before COVID, teachers would be with their students, depending on if they're elementary or middle school, for 1 hour to 7 hours a day. So these teachers really get to know their students. They get to know what they may be struggling with at home, if they have a parent who died, if they don't get along with their parents, if they fight with their siblings. If they're depressed, if they have suicidal ideation, the teachers get all of this information that I don't personally get firsthand because I don't get to see them as much as the teachers do. So the teachers sometimes will bring that information to me, and then we work together to see how we can best support the student. And I do that not just with teachers, but with parents as well. So I have parents who reach out and say, my student is struggling with academics, or just the other day, I had at least three parents who I connected with whose children are either currently having suicidal ideation, or one was 5150'd over the summer. Working with middle school students, there's a lot of suicide assessments that we have to do, which is such a difficult time for them. And especially right now with COVID, that's one of the main things we're working on. So I support students, teachers, parents in all those ways. And then I also facilitate meetings such as SST meetings, which are student study teams, as well as 504s, which are accommodation plan meetings. And all of that takes up a great deal of time. So there's other like small things that we do, but those are the basics of what we do as school counselors.
Yeah, I can imagine that your time is fairly limited and that you feel scattered at times, putting on different hats throughout the day and fulfilling different roles. So I wanted to point out that I was really encouraged by the way that you talk about how you collaborate with families as well as teachers to make sure that we're meeting our students' needs to the best that we can. I'm currently doing research on how to ensure that we have a healthy school community where it's not just the teachers and other staff who are really catching our students' needs, but all community members are involved, especially like the families that they're living with, but even like businesses and things like that. So it's really great to hear that you are kind of acting as a facilitator in this collaboration. That's really encouraging to hear. And you did mention something that I wanted to ask about. So you said you had a student who was it 50-50? Is that what you said?
Yeah, so it's actually police code. It's 5150, which is an individual who needs to be transported to the hospital for mental health reasons. So, that is something that often does happen in middle school and high schools, and I think not really a lot of people understand that that's the role of a school counselor. I think for many people, when they think school counselor, they think, oh, we help with scheduling and we kind of sit in our offices and wait for a student to come in who needs help. But we do a lot of suicide assessments, depending on the outcome of the assessment and depending on how high risk the student is for self-harm or risk of committing suicide. We either, if it's low risk, we call the parents and we inform them. If it's medium risk, maybe we'll have the SRO come to the school and do their own assessment, which is SRO is a student resource officer. So they are police officers who work like in school districts. So they kind of like circle around to all the schools in the district because we're calling them throughout the day. They're usually at the high school. If it is a student who is high risk, meaning they have the means and a plan to kill themselves, then we call the police. The police will come and they will transport the student to the hospital to be under evaluation.
Okay, thank you for clarifying that. And we'll talk more about suicide and different ways that counselors and teachers can help later on in the episode. For now, my next question is, what was the biggest issue that you feel was impacting your profession before COVID-19?
That's a really good question. I think kids these days have just so much going on. Things that maybe you and I didn't have when we were in school. Like kids have phones now and they have iPads and they have access to Instagram and TikTok and they have access to all these really crazy violent video games, and you can basically search for anything on the internet. And I think it's really hard for these kids because their brains aren't fully developed and it's hard to understand what is wrong and right, what is good for your brain to consume and what is unhealthy for your brain to consume. And new things are really interesting, especially at that younger age for elementary and middle school students. And I just think it's really hard for them, and I think it's really confusing, and I think that's definitely a big challenge that school staff and school counselors are having, is that they just have so much access, and I think it's confusing for them. So I think that's one of the major challenges.
Yeah, I see that too. I am definitely concerned with the accessibility for students, even if they have parents who are doing their best to keep an eye on what they're consuming online. It's very easy, I think, for kids, especially pre-COVID-19, to go over to a friend's house. Maybe their parents weren't watching as closely, so you don't know what your student or your child might be seeing when you're not around. So yeah, that is something that I will have a new episode about later on literacy and ways to protect our youth, because I do see this as impacting their mental health more so than it did, like you said, when we were kids or our older generations. So would you say that issue is the same that you are facing now, that's the most challenging for your profession, or has it shifted now with COVID-19?
I think for students, it might still be the most challenging thing. I think for school staff working in schools while we're doing online learning, if I can just talk about that for a little bit. I don't know if that's off
Of
topic,
course,
but
yes.
it's extremely difficult and it's different. And technology is hard and I don't understand technology. And it's just, I think people who don't work in schools or know people who work in schools maybe think, oh, teachers are just working from home and they probably work half days. And I hear, on the news people saying like we should get our tax dollars back. These teachers aren't doing as much as they were when they were teaching our students face to face. And I just wish people could get like a glimpse of what it is like to work in a school during COVID. It is insane. I am working way more hours than I was when we were in face-to-face school, when we were all at school. It's incredibly difficult to get students to attend online. I think attendance is a really hard thing right now because when we were all in face-to-face school, it was if you showed up to school, you were there. If you didn't show up, you were absent. If you were late, you were tardy. And it was simple. But now it's, oh, I tried to log on, but my camera wasn't working or my Zoom wasn't working and I kept getting kicked out. Or if students don't have their cameras on, teachers can mark them as tardy or absent. And there's just so many different layers to it. Like I get I've been hearing from a lot of teachers that they'll be teaching on Zoom and a student will have their camera off and say Kevin has his camera off, and the teacher will stop teaching and say, "Kevin, turn your camera on. Kevin, Kevin, turn your camera on." Kevin's not there. Kevin's probably in the other room watching TV.
Oh my
So
gosh.
it's just so hard for teachers, and it's hard to know, like, are they actually there? Are they listening to you? Are they responding? Or like they'll put students in a breakout room and then come back to class. But like the students don't come back because they're not sitting there clicking the button to go to the main room, or they'll be back in the main room and everybody else leaves, but like the student's still there. They're like playing video games or something. And I
Wow.
understand that. I understand the temptation. Like if I were in middle or elementary school and I could stay home, like I'd probably be playing Animal Crossing. I don't know. Like a lot of parents, they're both working. If students have two parents, maybe they're both working. Maybe they're both working out of the house, or maybe they're working inside the home. And if they're inside the home, that doesn't necessarily mean that they can be there to supervise their students because they're working and their kids are in a different room. So we actually had a student that was found unconscious on the floor. His parent walked in. And not sure how long he had been there. So that's why we're really stressing. You need to have your cameras on because your parents aren't supervising you. So your teacher can supervise you and make sure that you're okay, but only if your camera's on.
Wow, that must have
And
been
then I
so
know some,
scary.
yeah, and a lot of students, I think, don't want to have their camera on because they don't want people to see the inside of their house. And we have a lot of very well-off families where our school is located. And then we also have families who are in the low-income housing apartments. So maybe the students in the low-income housing apartments don't want the other kids to see what the inside of their home looks like. So there's just so many layers and so many factors. It's just very difficult. So I get upset when, I hear people say like schools need to get their stuff together. Like these school districts are amazing. My school district is amazing. We didn't have any notice. We were told on a Friday afternoon that we were going to be gone for 3 weeks. And now it's been, I don't know how many months. And then teachers had no prep. They had to start working. They were told Friday, we're all going. We're not coming back. And they had to start teaching online Monday. So I feel like sometimes teachers in school districts during COVID, they're not getting the credit that they deserve because it's extremely hard and we're doing the best that we can, but I feel like our best isn't enough. So it's difficult.
Oh, I definitely agree with you. Like, I've heard the saying, we're building the airplane as we're flying it. And I definitely believe this is true of anyone working in the education world right now, or probably working in the medical field as well. So it's just incredibly frustrating to me that the number of people who don't see the amount of work that you guys are putting in right now. I wish that we could definitely require that everyone just spend a day like observing what it's like in these difficult fields, because we need to have a level of empathy and a level of grace when we're talking about and with our schools. One of the main things that I am worried about is the way that this is going to affect the school image with families, because a big part of working with families is building that trust. And if that trust is broken throughout this time with COVID for reasons that are out of the school's control, I just worry about the effects it's going to have on future with our schools. Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah. So, Jill, besides supporting students, a big part of the day for school counselors I've worked with has been supporting teachers. And you talked a little bit about how you do social and emotional lessons, and you also partner with them with specific issues that the teacher is seeing with her students, and that you've been a resource for staff. Do you support the staff at all with things like secondhand trauma?
Yeah, so we do. We have had the district I've worked in, we've had a lot of loss the past 2 years. Last year, we had three students die in a car accident from the high school.
I'm so
So
sorry
that
to hear that.
was, yeah, that was really hard, not only for the students, but for the teachers, because they had, maybe they were, the teachers knew them for 3 or 4 years and they had these relationships with them, and the teachers just lost that. And another thing that we try to remember as counselors is that in that situation, even if there was a teacher that didn't know the students or have a strong relationship with them, knowing that that happened can bring up grief and trauma from someone else that has passed in their life. So we wanted to make sure, like, even at the elementary and middle school levels, we all supported the teachers, we supported the counselors there because they were very busy. They had a vigil at the high school that all of the counselors went to just to show our support and to be there in case anyone needed to talk. We also had an incident just about 2 weeks ago where one of our teachers died in the district. So that was really hard for other teachers who knew that teacher. So anytime something traumatic happens like that, we always reach out to the teachers and we always let them know we're here for you. We're not just here for the students, we're here to support you, because I feel like sometimes they forget that. So sometimes just at the bottom of my emails, I'll always say, like, I'm here for you as well if you need anything. Because I feel like some teachers think they can only connect with us if they need support with a student, but we are at the school to support everyone, students, teachers, staff, parents. We're just there to help whenever needed.
Great. I'm glad to hear that you see yourself as a resource for the staff as well. I know that I've worked in two different districts, and both counselors have been amazing and totally willing to help the staff as well as the students. So I was just curious if that's something that's kind of written into your job description, or do you think it's something that you do additionally just because you feel it's the right thing to do?
I mean, in our job description, it does say to support staff, but I'm not sure if that's at the level that school counselors take it to. And I think we just want to help. Like, if you're a student or a teacher, if you're in need, we want to help. So I think we maybe go a little bit farther than what is written in our job descriptions, but we know that teachers can't be good teachers if they are carrying around a bunch of trauma or if they are very anxious or sad or upset. So we want to make sure that they're taken care of and they have the support that they need.
Great. Well, as a teacher, I definitely appreciate the role that counselors take, and they have definitely supported me in my career. So my next question is kind of a follow-up on this one. I've seen headlines for the past couple of years on a shortage of school counselors in some areas of our country due to funding issues. Like, I know that California was definitely pushing to gain more counselors in Oregon as well. So in an ideal world where funding wasn't an issue, what do you think would be the best possible student to counselor ratio?
That's a really good question. So, according to ASCA, which is the American School Counselor Association, the proper ratio is 250 students to one counselor. And I don't know any school that has that ratio. And I understand it's very difficult. It's a lot of funding, and there's a lack of funding in our country for education. And I am very grateful that the district I work in very highly values their counselors to the point where they have a full-time counselor in every elementary school. And you would think that, that's normal, but it's really not. Up until 2 years ago, Each elementary counselor was part-time at each school. So they would be at one elementary school 2.5 days a week, and then they had their other elementary school they were designated to where they were at for the other 2.5 days a week. So I'm very, very grateful that the district I work for highly values counselors, and they had the budget to hire a lot of counselors. So when I was hired 2 years ago, that was when they switched from having a counselor at every two elementary schools to having one counselor at every elementary school. So they hired about six counselors, which was why I was able to get hired. So I think the ratio of 250 to 1 would be amazing, and I think we would be able to do our jobs a little bit better and support students a little bit more thoroughly. But unfortunately, I don't think it's realistic. I know last year my caseload was about 650 students, and I think I'm either at that number now or a little bit higher. Hopefully in the future we start to see more counselors in some schools so we can really, really support students in the way that we want to. Because when students have a calm nervous system, they are able to learn better and they're able to be sitting in their seat and they're able to retain information. And that's kind of the foundation of our job, is that when we help students with social and emotional aspects of their lives, that they are able to focus more on academics. So, I'm hoping in the next few years that other school districts will be able to have as many counselors as we do.
Yes, I definitely hope that as well. And unfortunately, it's not just counselors who are overburdened with caseloads. I know that the last school that I worked at, due to some very unique situations, we only had a principal for one out of our two elementary schools. So she would spend 3 days at one school and two at the other each week,
Wow.
and it was exhausting for her. And the counselor definitely had to step up and take on more administration work, which impacted their ability to do their job. So funding is something that I think is really a big issue in our country. And obviously, with COVID-19 causing layoffs and the economic downturn that we've had, I'd be interested to see how progressively we can start giving schools the resources that they're going to need. Because I don't know if you've read very many studies, I'm sure that you have as a counselor. But I've been reading some studies just showing the numbers of students living in trauma, how it's growing so quickly with COVID. And so I just see the need for counselors. It's just growing so fast right now. And it's going to be interesting to see just how COVID-19 really affects the social and emotional well-being of our students and our staff. So, thank you for all of the hard work you are obviously putting in, and all of the counselors. I want to take the time to really shout you guys out because you guys are doing amazing.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. So, a big part of what I address in this podcast is actually social justice. So, what is your perspective on the Black Lives Matter as a counselor?
As a counselor, I think the Black Lives Movement is amazing and it's so important, and we all need to be paying attention and we all need to be listening. I think it's just very unfortunate, the circumstances that led to this movement. That this movement even needs to be happening is very disappointing, that we needed to wait for George Floyd to be killed to be able to all stand up and come together and try to make change happen. And I know at our school district, it wasn't until this movement started that we are talking about
gaining and incorporating like social justice and cultural equality curriculum into our classrooms for K through eight. So I think it's really amazing that this movement is leading us in that direction, but I also wonder why wasn't this happening before? And I also wonder what other school districts are doing and if they've had social justice curriculum implemented before and what that looked like and how it's changing. So I think the movement is very necessary, and I'm glad that it's still going strong, even though it's been a few months. It's just very unfortunate the circumstances that had to bring about this. So I'm really excited to see, hopefully next year we'll be rolling out some social justice curriculum for our students.
Excellent. And I know that this might be early on for your school district specifically, but do you guys know any specific curriculum programs that you're looking into currently?
No, not that I know of. I know we haven't had those deep conversations yet in length. I think our district social worker is aware of some curriculum that we might be able to use. So I think we just really need to, as a district, set aside that time and figure out what our goal is and kind of find a way to implement that, using the correct curriculum to make sure that our students become well-rounded human beings. Because I think that's very important. Now we're not just teaching our students math and English and science, we're teaching them how to be kind and respectful people.
Definitely. I'm very encouraged to hear that your district is moving towards focusing on this really valid movement and that you guys are going to the drawing board to see how you can have equity in mind when you are choosing curriculum, because that's one of the basic elements of ensuring that our students are feeling heard and seen and that they are developing the characteristic that we would hope a citizen would have. And since you brought curriculum, I do want to take this moment to shout out a great resource that maybe would be helpful for your school district. It's called Reading with Relevance, and you can go to readingwithrelevance.org, and they actually have book studies that teachers can use. And this is for social and emotional learning, but it really ties nicely with English language learning. Or English language arts, excuse me. So it's just something that you might want to look out for. I mentioned it in my last episode, but I just wanted to bring it up again. They have different book studies for like The Hate U Give and Ghost Boy and all of those.
I will definitely look into that. Thank you for the recommendation.
Of course. The next topic I wanted to discuss was often teachers feel the urge to become a fill-in therapist for their students because of how we were talking about your caseload is so high. And we just were seeing what is happening with our students in all the time. So it's very natural, I think, for teachers to want to help their students in any way that they can. But since we're not trained as therapists, obviously we have to be really careful with any recommendations we make for students or their families, and making sure that we are consulting counselors. So do you have any suggestions or cautions to offer teachers who might be trying to fill in that therapy role?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I know that teachers now are, I mean, I think in teaching credential programs, they are educated and trained on teaching with social and emotional learning in mind. And I know that teachers now, they don't just need to meet the academic standards, but now they also kind of need to meet standards of teaching students regarding social and emotional learning. So
I think it's a lot to take on. And I think from what I've seen, they do a great job. I guess my suggestion would be, instead of giving advice, what you should do is simply validate their feelings. And I know it doesn't sound like much, but I think when you start going into the area of giving advice, it can get really, really sticky. And even as a trained counselor, I shy away from giving advice because that's not really my place. My place as a counselor is to listen and to reflect your thoughts and feelings back to you and help support you so you can make choices that are good for you. So I think for teachers, if they want to help their students in that role, instead of giving advice, just reflect their feelings back. If a student comes to you and says, like, I just don't want to go home, like my parents are really mean and it makes me scared, and you can just reflect back to them, you don't want to go home because your parents are mean and that makes you feel really scared. And as simple as it sounds to just repeat someone's feelings back to them, it's very, very validating. Even when people do that to me, like when I was in grad school and we had to kind of, do therapy on each other. And it's just very validating when someone reflects that back to you, when it's like they understand. So I think for teachers, that might seem like a very simple thing that doesn't make a difference, but it really does. And I would say, when in doubt, refer to your counselor or school psych, or go talk to your counselor or school psych before giving any suggestions or advice specifically regarding mental health, either with students or parents, just because it can get sticky. So just stay on the safe side and just go consult with a counselor or a school psychologist.
Really excellent advice. Because I know my last year of teaching, I found myself in situations where students were telling me things that were concerning to me, and I wanted to fix the problem right then and there because it's very easy for the relationship between a student and a teacher, especially when they're at a young age, for it to become more than just academics. Like you get very like invested in that student's life. So taking a step back and talking to the counselor, I think, is always a good step before intervening. So the next question is, we know that suicide has become increasingly more common for students, especially in the 14 to 24 age group. I've seen students as young as second grade killing themselves, so it's not something that's just with that middle school, high school age group. And according to a study I've read, suicide rates for adolescents has doubled since the 1950s. So, do you have any advice for teachers and counselors to assist students who are dealing with this issue, like early warning signs?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's also kind of a difficult question to answer because, from what I've seen, students kind of present signs differently. And you mentioned that, we're seeing younger students talk about suicide, and it's very interesting how they even have that vocabulary. I was talking to a teacher the other day, and she's like, I just don't even know how this student knows these words. Like, who was in second grade and knows what suicide means? Like, it's very strange. And I think that goes back to earlier when we talked about exposure and how maybe it's from movies or TV shows or video games or online chatting that these students have these understandings of things that they probably wouldn't hear of until they were at least in middle school or high school if it wasn't for all the exposure. For warning signs, it can be a little tricky. I would say, teachers, they really connect with their students and have this really unique bond. And I think teachers are really good
knowing when something's wrong. Teachers really understand their students' body language. They see their students every day. They know if their student usually sits up in class. They know if their student is usually asleep in class. They know if their student always raises their hands and participates or doesn't. So I think it's really easy for teachers to see changes in students' behavior, which could be a warning sign. Also, looking out for any signs of cutting, of seeing any marks on students' arms or wrists or any other cut marks on the body. I know that students are usually really good at covering them with long sleeves or hoodies, and that could be another sign. If a student, it's like a really hot day and a student's coming to school in like a sweatshirt, and you think something might be going on, I would say talk to your counselor. And sometimes students are just so lost that they're not even going to hide it. Sometimes they're just going to tell you, I don't feel like living, or I really want to hurt myself, or I really want to die. And hearing a student say that is extremely heartbreaking, and it's very confusing because a lot of us can't imagine what that feels like to have those things inside of us feeling like you don't want to live anymore. So I just say, like, teachers, you know your students. You kind of intuitively know when something is up. And just make sure, if you have a concern about a student, I would say stay connected with the school counselor. Another way to tell if a student may be suicidal or considering self-harm is that some students will write about it in, like, their English assignments, is what I've seen. For instance, the other day I was forwarded an assignment from an English teacher, and she had the students writing an assignment about sacrifice. And this student wrote this whole assignment about what her life is like and how she can't have the things that she wants. And she was talking about COVID and how, like, even if I could have these things, I can't because of COVID. And what's the point of living? So sometimes those things will come out in students' writings, and it may be that they were unaware of what they were writing, or it might be a cry for help. So for teachers, if you ever see any signs of, like, suicidal ideation or self-harm in a student's writing, I would suggest immediately taking it to a counselor or an administrator, because we never know what a student is going to do, and we need to use every hint they give us and every word they tell us. And we need to use that to kind of determine how at risk these students are.
That's a great point, because a lot of times it'll be just like the everyday conversations, or like you said, the assignments that can be a great tip off. I know that a lot of times students who are struggling with suicidal thoughts struggle to know who they should talk to, especially if they've been living with trauma. What I've read in studies is that students who live in a household or in a situation where they are not in a healthy relationship with their caregivers, they lack a sense of trust with any person of authority that they might see. And then a lot of times kids will associate authority with adulthood. So it's interesting to me to see which students are feeling suicidal, but who we might not even know because they're not giving warning signs, or they don't trust the adults in their lives at school. That's why I think it's really important to have some type of universal intervention system for the entire school or the district, some type of policy for curriculum teaching, for friends who might be confided in, like a second grade friend is told that their second grade friend is having these ideas about killing themselves, or maybe it's in middle school. And I know that during my own education in middle school, I was told things by friends, and I was the student who always knew that I need to go to an adult if it's something that I can't fix myself. And so luckily my friends, they weren't happy about it, obviously, but I did save them from situations. So I was just curious if your school district or any districts that you know of have some type of universal intervention for suicide prevention.
Yeah, so we do have a suicide prevention. I think it's a whole month that we dedicate to suicide prevention, and that's for middle and high school. And last year I worked only with K through eight. I was only with elementary students. So we didn't have those presentations for elementary students because it's just not age appropriate. But this year, me working with K through eight, I will be, me and the other counselor will be in charge of putting together lessons and getting together resources for suicide prevention. So this is going to be my first year doing it. I find it quite intimidating. And I think as counselors, we're trained to be very direct and not sugarcoat words. But still, like when I do a suicide assessment and I have to ask a student, because I'm reading the questions from like the district risk assessment, and it says, like, in the past week, have you thought about killing yourself? Have you thought about ending your life? Do you think that your parents would be better off if you're dead? Just like reading those phrases out loud is just feels very strange and very unnatural. And I know, like, as counselors, we're kind of desensitized to a lot of stuff, but that's one thing that I just don't think I ever will get desensitized to. So I am excited to collaborate with other middle school counselors in the district and find out what curriculum we use and what we do for presentations, because I think it would be very awkward to go into a classroom and talk about suicide for 20 minutes and be like, okay, bye, like, get back to your math work.
Yeah,
that's very strange to me.
Yeah, I do think that it is kind of jarring the way that schools have taken to teaching interventions, like you look at like sex education or suicide prevention education, anything that's kind of taboo or difficult to talk about. I think that we need to find a more natural way to approach these types of conversations. And it's hard on any professional to be put in situations where they feel like they have to talk about these things, but maybe they don't feel comfortable yet. So I definitely empathize with you, and I hope that it goes well for you and your colleagues as you guys just kind of figure out how to approach this topic with young people. So I've been reading a study about a universal and then a targeted intervention approach, and the universal approach sounded more like it was embedded with curriculum a bit more, and it was more of how to take care of your community and how to take care of your peers, and maybe it wasn't verbalized so startling for the students. Like, it never mentions killing yourself, but maybe it talks about, is your friend being withdrawn, or are they not wanting to play with you as much as they used to? Just that way we can have their peers also observing and looking for those signals that maybe something's not okay. Maybe it's not suicide, but something's not okay. I would be interested to see if any type of curriculum like that is presented or produced. And if I find anything like that, I'll definitely send it your way as well.
That would be great.
Thank you, Jill, so much for being willing to talk with me. And for those who are listening, to get an insight on what it's like to be a counselor. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that maybe we didn't get a chance to?
No, I don't think so, but I just want to thank you so much for having me. I know that when we're really passionate about what we do or something we have in our lives, we just want to talk about it and share it with people. So I want to thank you for giving me that outlet to share what I'm passionate about.
I I want to thank Jill for joining us today. If you enjoyed what we talked about, be sure to like and subscribe. Proceeds from this episode will be donated to Save the Children. You can learn more about how you can support us and what we talked about today by visiting us at highedpod.com. Join me next week as I will be joined by a guest to speak on the foster care system and how educators can ensure they are serving this unique student population to the best of their abilities.